Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Scottish Watches podcast. You made it. This is episode 100. And for those of you that have been checking and blaming me for the fact that last week there was only one episode and not two, it was all part of a master plan.
Because it wasn't. Yes, it was.
It was deep state planning that I forgot to send the audio for episode 99 until after episode 99 was due to go out. And that was so that episode 100 fell with today's guest. Today's guest means that we're finished, because we said this about 20 episodes ago.
In fact, probably about 70
episodes ago, that if we ever got this person on the show, that would be it. We'd have completed podcasting, much like those sticker albums you get for football. So, without further ado, I have one question for this gentleman. Mr. Mosso, are you speaking to us with your sunglasses on your head today?
How do you not?
I feel honoured that not only are you on the podcast, but you have brought your sunglasses with you. That it's not just a video thing, it's actually a full lifestyle thing you've got going on with the sunglasses inverted on your head.
Rick, have you ever seen X-Men?
I have seen the X-Men.
And when Charles puts on the helmet when he goes into Cerebrum and it allows him to just channel all the thoughts. Well, that's how Tim channels the thoughts of the watch industry.
Oh, is that right? Right, okay. It suddenly all makes sense. Our guest today, and we are delighted that he's found the time to come on at long last, is Tim Mosso. So say hello to the good people who listen to the Scottish Watches podcast.
Hey, folks, far flung. Thanks so much, first, for supporting all I do on the YouTube and the Instagram, but also for welcoming me to Scottish Watches. We've been talking about doing this for a while, and I always felt awful because I kept stonewalling it. Something always came up, and now I'm here, and it's like, I don't think I've ever worked so hard to put out a piece of social media in my entire life, and I do this for a living. So it's great to finally sink the shot, as we say in the United States.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. We're very much looking forward to this conversation. But let's actually do a wristwatch check as to what Tim has chosen to wear. And Tim, you better not be naked-wristed today.
You're going to love what I'm wearing this morning. I'm actually preparing to do something over at my office. So on my left, I've got my usual Zin Easy M11, the 500-piece limited series from 2017. And then on my right wrist, I've got a watch that means, you might even say, more to me, because it's from the formative era of like hard rock and heavy metal. It is a 1974 Jaeger LeCoultre Memovox Snowdrop, the E877, and it's the black dial model. And this particular watch is the watch I always wear to Blue Oyster Cult concerts, because they were of that era. That's when Astronomy came out. That was the beginning of metal and hard rock, and I wear that watch, and that's when I'm rocking.
So are you going to a gig tonight? Is this why you're wearing it today?
Well, I'm about to. I wish I were. I actually saw the Blue Oyster Cult 2 weeks ago. They were awesome. They get better with time. And it's funny because you realize the passage of time. The lead singer casually mentioned on stage that he was turning 75 the next day.
Was the Zimmer frame not a giveaway?
No, no, no. The watch on my wrist, the Snowdrop, it's the only JLC I kept. You guys might know that I pared down my collection about a year ago. Yes. And so that watch for me was the most emotionally charged piece and also the hardest one to replace, because I spent more time trying to find that watch, you know, which, I mean, $3,000 is not a ton of money compared to Tourbillon, the Perpetual Calendar, some of the heavier pieces I owned. But because of the amount of emotional stress and strain that went into finding it, it was the one I knew I could never easily repurchase on a whim. So I kept it, and I've built up these memories around concerts, and I'm riding that wave. I put a new patch on my Blue Oyster Cult shirt on the back every time I see the band.
Excellent.
Is that like when you go to a coffee shop and you get five coffees and then you get your sixth one for free?
Yeah, I was thinking of it more along the lines of like a Battle of Britain Spitfire, where you have an ME-109 on the nose, you cross one off for every enemy you down, you know, for every kill in the sky. It's kind of like each Blue Oyster Cult show, I add a patch. And I'm thinking at some point of getting a little patch that looks like the watch, because it's the easiest thing on earth. The watch is lugless. It's a circle with a black dial. I could probably make that patch myself.
So for the listeners who don't know, how old are you, Tim?
I'm 35.
Wow, okay. You've crammed a lot of knowledge into 35 years on this planet, put it that way. And on the JLC front, obviously, it was actually quite a bit of a shock for me, I don't know about Rick, when you announced that you were paring down the collection. Was there a reason behind that?
There was. I think two reasons. First, I had jumped straight into the watch space in 2014, and I have to admit, most of what I know about watches and the tastes I formed, they were formed relatively quickly after I got out of the Navy back in 2013. So in terms of collecting, I was sort of on my, I would say my baby steps as a collector. I decided I was going to pick a collection theme, and I was going to stick to it very rigidly because I thought, well, look, if I love everything, then I'm just going to buy watches endlessly. I'll be out of money in no time. So I'm just going to buy one brand that I really love, and I'm going to pursue important references and important complications and styles, and I'm going to build up a profile of this brand. And I was so rigidly fixated on that theme, and it was so successful as a theme that within about 3 years I had everything I originally planned to amass, but I also realized that I was buying watches dutifully. Like I was saying, oh, you know, I have to have JLC XYZ, I have to have an ultra thin dress watch, I have to have a calendar only watch. And then I realized of the 10 I had, maybe 4 got consistent wrist time. So by locking myself into a fixed view of what I should buy and putting myself on a track, you know, I failed to buy a lot of Ulysse Nordin and Omega and Zin watches that didn't fit the collection theme, but I would have loved and worn more than the JLCs I actually bought. So having reached the end of the line where I had every watch I originally thought I wanted to build out the portfolio, it's almost like I reached the end of the rainbow and I found the pot of gold, or I'm the dog who caught the car and that didn't know what to do. So, yeah. You know, I was at an inflection point as a collector where it was just time to reboot because there was nowhere to take that collection theme. It was fulfilled, and some of these watches just weren't getting worn.
It all seemed to be brought to a head because there was a certain JLC that became available via Watchbox that you were clearly road testing. Can you remind us all of what that was?
Well, there was, at the end of the line, a minute repeater. And what I wanted to do was honor the LeCoult and Jaeger LeCoult tradition of minute repeaters, because of the hundreds of calibers that they already had by the year 1900, dozens of them were minute repeaters, and they were the preferred Bausch supplier for chiming watches in the Vallée du Jour in the late 19th century. So the master minute repeater that came out in 2005 was very much the successor to those. It was incredibly loud. It had incredible tone and sustain. 15-day power reserve, extraordinary finish, and the boutique model, which was made in about 30 pieces in platinum with a black lacquer dial, that was specifically the model. And, you know, I was, after a few years of saving and planning for this, you know, prioritizing life the way we do when we have big goals, you know, I was ready to buy it. And having achieved my goal, the last piece of the puzzle was in my hand, or I should say on my wrist. I just thought, I need to like step back from this. This is the job done. And having tasted it, I didn't feel like I needed to own it for years to get the experience. I was so familiar with the watch from years of research and evaluating individual examples for condition and performance and movement health that after wearing that one, I really did feel like I needed to step back and engage my imagination again. Because what happens when we become too fixated on one thing, we block out all of the alternatives and everything they have to offer. And I turned around, I looked away from my wrist, and I said, I'm actually more into what's not on my wrist and the watches that are not into my collection than I am to my collection. And let me be frank, there's also the understanding that with group brands, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got as a collector was don't love brands because they won't love you back. And so where that left me was realizing that I would never have any kind of rapport or relationship with a Richemont brand. And if I wanted to be closer to the watches, and if I really wanted to enjoy the fraternity, not just of other collectors, but also of the people who make the watch, I would probably have to look to smaller brands and independents. And coming from cycling, which is my great passion, you know, I ride a custom frame, and I know the man who made that bike. And I own American guitars, and I'm in contact with the company that makes those guitars when I need to send them for service. I know the name of the guy who's going to do the work. So having that personal relationship for me on the watch side was very important. And I realized with Jaeger LeCoultre and Richemont, it was never going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, and it was interesting watching you going through the torment of making these decisions almost live on your YouTube broadcast as people in the chat boxes were going, buy it, versus people going, well, you know, make your own mind, do your own thing. And you seem to have taken them up under what you've said in that you've developed a relationship clearly with Dave Bethune and Danny Flagelly. And these are the kind of brands that you're now feeling much closer to.
Very much. And the other thing is, it's not even just one person at that brand. De Bethune and the U.S. distributor, their CEO, their watchmaker, some of their most important collectors. Like, I've had contact with all of them, and it's all been very positive. And, you know, I'm not saying that people who work for the group brands aren't wonderful folks. It's just that, practically speaking, there's almost no way to know them and have a relationship unless you're that guy who's dropping $30,000 on a new watch four times a year. You know, that kind of relationship that's bought and paid is never the kind that I'll have. I will never be that guy with that kind of money. So the independents really offer the only avenue to get that much closer to the watch. And, you know, with something like an independent, like a De Bethune, an MB&F, even small one-man brands like Karsten Frostdorf, you can get so close to the process that you might even, you know, as a one-off customer, be able to get something that is custom for you, or to be invited to a personal discussion with Max Busser of MB&F, or an opportunity to meet a Philippe Dufour. It's just one of those, I think, reactions to the way the watch industry is structured now, that people are pulling away, I think, from, I would even say, the vintage scene now. What people sought during the 2000s and the early 2010s in vintage, which was authenticity and soul, I think increasingly people are searching for that and finding it in independence and the independent brands.
Yeah. It read to me there that you were on a path to collect things and you were basically just stamp collecting. And I've seen this in forums and groups where people, when they get into the hobby, they get channeled into, right, I need to have a sub, I need to have a speedy, I need to have an X, a Y, a Z before they feel as if they're accomplished. And it takes them away from actually experiencing new things and finding their own feet. The watches you've mentioned there on your journey are fantastic pieces. I was over, thankfully or luckily, just a couple of weeks ago at GLC, and I had the factory tour and they showed me the museum and everything and went through the history. So I can understand how you get so caught up in it. But then you told me a minute ago that you've only been into the hobby for 5 years, and that is an incredible journey to take. So how did you stumble into horology?
Well, I remember being interested in watches as a kid, but it was at a very low level. Back in the 1990s, I had no sense that there was a broader watch community. As a teenager, I had a G-Shock. I was into my grandpa's old watch, which was cool. After he passed away, that came my way. I loved them the same way I loved cars, but unlike the car community, where you can go into any drugstore or bookstore and you see that there are magazines and journals and hobby, you know, hobby periodicals, there was no visible watch community. I had no idea that the watch community was even a thing, that there were collectors, that there were publications, that there were trade shows at Basel and Geneva. So I was sort of into watches in the 90s, but I had no sense that there was anyone else who felt the way I did. Now, during the 2000s, with the rise of online watch communities, forums, time zone, peer-to-peer sales boards and digital fora, all of a sudden I could see that there were other people who had this interest, and then I started paying more attention. I felt, okay, it's not just a weird whim and whimsy on my part. And then finally, during my Navy years, I realized that when I needed to chill and disconnect from, you know, what could occasionally be a fairly intense job and lifestyle, the way I did it was I would open up the watch sites and read the news and go on and chat watches on Watch Pro Site or Time Zone or Watch You Seek. And so when I left in 2013, my thought was, okay, for the first time in 4 years, my time is all my own. What am I going to do with it? I'm going to say I was in Navy Public Affairs. I'm going to see if I can find someone in the watch space who needs a press officer or a press attaché or a ghostwriter. And I found it in Florida. Almost as soon as I left the Navy, a company called Watch You Want that sold pre-owned watches was looking for exactly that kind of ghostwriter and kind of press conduit and public relations I suppose, specialist, you could say. And so I went to them. Yeah. And initially, they wanted blogs written online. And I'm sure you guys have found that your website, you know, it gets attention and plaudits and reads. And that's a wonderful way to reach out. But if you really want to reach people today, it's got to be a video or a podcast format, because the people who are going to make the money from websites are the ones that have been established for 10, 15, 20 years and have all that past publication to index on Google. So I told Watch You Want, forget about the blogs. No one's gonna read a vendor blog. Nothing has less traction or credibility. Let me make some videos of these watches and put it on your YouTube channel that's been derelict since you opened it in 2011. And that quickly received a lot of attention, because although I call the watch videos reviews, they're really just overviews. How big is it? What does it do? What are its specifications? Can I get a look at it on a wrist? And that became the single best outreach in terms of energy in versus payoff of anything we ever did. And so I just started running with that until the company was bought by Govberg in 2016. And then Govberg, in turn, was bought by private equity and became Watchbox. So I've just sort of taken a step up the staircase at every waypoint along the journey from Watch You Want to Watchbox.
You focused always on the media side within Watch You Want and Govberg. Do you actually know how many minutes of video and how many watches you have actually handled? Because it must be, you must lay claim, surely, to the most number of minutes of video and the most handled number of watches of anybody on YouTube.
Oh, yeah, to be sure. I can tell you that my individual videos of watches amount to roughly, and I'm giving you a rough number because we lost count after a point, but I've shot roughly 4,500 individual watch videos. So 4,500 individual watch videos. The watch time on the channel I created in mid-2017. So there was the original Watch You Want channel that later became Watchbox Studios, and I'm only occasionally involved in that side anymore, but I've focused on Watchbox reviews since 2017. And that channel, if you were to add up all of the minutes, it would be the equivalent of 145 years, 259 days of watch time.
Yeah. I mean, is there going to be anybody else in the world that will have handled as many different watches as you have? I mean, who would you need to be? Maybe an auctioneer, possibly?
I would say realistically, in the last 5 years, the time that I've been in this space, I would safely say that no one has handled as many watches, because if I have shot 4,500 watches, then the watches that I've personally inspected, evaluated, handled, or explained firsthand that didn't even get to the video stage, like they came in, I explained them to clients, I would say no one has probably handled as many in the last 5 years, because if I've handled the 4,500 or on YouTube, the real number is probably north of 10,000 individual models. So those are different models, not five different Submariners of the same reference.
Yes. Yeah.
So have you seen things change over the last X amount of years then? Because I remember going back when I first got into this hobby, 2017, which is around about the same time that Rick did as well, I saw Watch You Want videos. It was at the time, it was you, I think it was OJ Watley, it was Josh and a few other folks, and the content was really good. It was multiple times per week. It was with a good length that you could sit down and actually watch it start to finish. But then I went back the way, and your reviews started literally with an iPhone and a white backdrop. So how did it go from there to where you guys are just now?
Well, I'm actually talking to you over the iPhone that was used to take those first videos. It is a 2013 iPhone 5, and the idea at the time was do it cheaply. We did not have a lot of money as Watch You Want. We, as a vendor, we had a huge cash burn rate, so everything had to go into buying and selling watches. And if it was a question of buying me a camera or making a wire transfer today, the answer would always be make the wire transfer. So I had a phone, I strapped it to a chair, I held it on with a piece of duct tape, and then I put...
Is this a phone you're talking about here?
This is a cell phone. This is an old cell phone. And I strapped it to a chair, like the back of a chair. I turned the chair backwards, and I sat on that chair while looking over the edge of the chair at the watch and wrapping my two arms around the chair to hold the watch. I put a wrist pad underneath the watch, the kind of wrist pad you'd place in front of your keyboard, and then I draped a branded Watch You Want polishing cloth over over that wrist pad. And that was the original format. There were no wrist shots. Sometimes I didn't show the case back. I was just trying to establish what on earth 5 or 6 minute watch review would look like. And so again, it was just done because I could shoot a lot of them. Before then, Watch You Want had tried YouTube, but they always thought that you needed scripts, you needed editing, post-production, you needed to bring in a video specialist. And I said, I think I can do this in one pass, and I think I can post it the same day I shoot it. And they said, okay, go for it. And that was the original idea. Use a phone, do it quickly, do it without post-production or video specialists, and basically do it with sunken costs with the phone you've already got.
This sounds like Rick playing with TikTok last week.
Listen, TikTok's the future. Me and Tim are going to do a deal afterwards for me to put all of his videos onto TikTok for 1 minute for my 60-second watch reviews.
It's going to be called Tim Talk.
We're going to be rich beyond your wildest imaginations.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Or not, as the case may be.
So apart from the watches, give us a bit of your history about cars then, because you've mentioned a few big hitters like some Audis and things like that on the show. So what's your experience there?
Cars mean a great deal to me, and not just because they're a pastime and, you know, a real cultural touchstone here in the United States, but also because all of my literacy, my ability to write, speak, and read, that all comes from being a kid obsessed with car magazines. And I found that back before just about everything suffered a general degradation in quality of journalism, you read finance magazines and car magazines, and they were the most literate periodicals you could find. So it's not just that I love cars, but I am who I am today, and I am speaking the way I'm speaking, both here and on YouTube, because of those car magazines. And so culturally, cars have always been something that excited me. I loved riding them as a kid. I loved the look of them, the sound of them. My dad would take me to car shows, and you know, the big pilgrimage each year was right around the house, right around the corner from our house. It was the All British Car Show at a local park. And so I have owned Audis, and I've had two D2 S8s, as well as a first generation TTRS, which was in Nogaro blue, which was kind of like a purple blue Audi exclusive color. Mm-hmm. I've also had a B5 generation S4, which was carrying too much turbo boost for its own good, and that proved to be the end of it. But yeah, I'm actually between collector cars right now. What I found was I've got the Chevy Volt, because the mistake I always made was trying to make a fun car or a collector car my everyday drive, and I would wind up driving it on days when I realized it should be in the garage. It shouldn't be out on salt. It shouldn't be out on sand. It shouldn't be out in the rain. It shouldn't be out in the cold. And so I would always have this conflict between wearing out the cool car and the need to use it daily. So I've got this Chevy Volt that I bought used, and it's basically a plug-in hybrid, and that basically handles the blows of life in the Northeast. When someone bangs into it in Philadelphia, I don't like suffer that blow to my soul or bruise to my heart that I would if that had been the Audi. So that's going to be like my excuse to buy the crazy collector car that comes next. I can honestly tell you that between watches and cars, my next major arrival is going to be a car. So my passion is generally for older stuff. Like there was I don't want to cut you off. You guys intercede at any point here. But last night on my show, some people were faulting me for not recognizing the Ferrari in the background of a wrist shot someone sent me. And I think I called it a 430, and it was a 488. And I should have known that because I watch the 488 all the time in GT3 racing. But at the same time, I'm not into like modern Ferraris and Lamborghinis. Like if you gave me a chance to drive a 2000 Dodge Viper ACR, for me, that's a race car. That's the 3-time Le Mans champion. Or I could drive a Ferrari F8 Tributo. I got to admit, I don't know the first thing about the F8, whereas the Viper, to me, it's part of the pantheon because it was raced. I love older cars that have a racing history. I love cars that I see at collector shows. I love cars that I remember from my childhood. You know, that Viper was my hero car back in high school. I would wait every year for the Motor Trend speeding issue where they test the top speeds and full performance ranges of cars. And every year, I'd look to see where the Viper was, where the Aston Martin DB7 was. How did the latest Ferrari, the 355 originally, and then later on the 360 fare? So I'm not always up to speed on modern cars. I love race cars and I love older cars, especially the ones that were the giants of my childhood.
So what's the car on the list?
Oh boy.
Or is it a secret? Is it a trade secret?
No, no. I'm,
we won't tell anyone.
I told you guys, I actually, in spite of my multiple Germans, my real weakness is for cars that have a racing history and British cars. So I love the Peynos Roadster. It's a aluminum roadster based on a, I believe it was a Frank Costin chassis that was briefly built in the UK. And then Danny Peynos bought the chassis rights and he moved the, once that original company folded, he moved the production to Brazelton, Georgia. And his dad, Don, then decided to promote the company by going racing. And so I watched the Peynos racing team in the 90s and the 2000s. And, you know, those were my sports heroes. My sports heroes, you know, they didn't play with sticks and balls. They played with horsepower, cylinders, gasoline. They were non-traditional athletes, but guys like David Brabham and Tom Christensen and Olivier Beretta, you know, those were my racing heroes, and a lot of my racing heroes drove Peynos cars. So the AIV Roadster, they made 176 from 1996 to 1999. Also, I love 6 3/4 liter Bentleys.
I was going to say, just for those that don't know what a Peynos is, it's a bit like a Caterham 5 in kind of scale. Would that be right?
Caterham 7.
The AIV Roadster.
Caterham 7, yeah. Is that kind of look of car, just for those that are listening that aren't car buffs, it's got that kind of look of an open-top roadster, a wheel in each corner and not much metal surrounding
it. That's right. If you can imagine a car with front fenders that turn with the wheels, that's exactly what it looks like.
And then the Bentley, you're interested
yeah,
in?
Yeah, I just love them because they're built beautifully, and I look around the world and I see, okay, these are all McMansions, the trophy houses of this generation. They'll be torn down by the next generation. I look at the public spaces and I say, we don't have pride in public works anymore. We don't build anything that's going to stand for 1,000 years. There's going to be no architectural legacy from our generations to the next. And I look at something like a crew-built Bentley and I say, oh my God, the wool, the leather, the chrome, the metalwork, this should last 100 years. Someone should make themselves the custodian of this. It's hand-built. It's a work of art. It's decadent, opulent, and in some ways a little bit antisocial because it is so excessive. But my God, it deserves to live. It deserves to survive. And I sense a permanence in those cars that's a lot like what draws me to watches, that sort of sense that you're talking about something designed to last, a car for life or a watch for life. And it's just an exception to everything else in our time. And then I do have to admit a weakness for Aston Martin and the first generation Vanquish V12. I love that a great deal. And I thought of picking up, and again, for our general audience, if you remember the last car that Pierce Brosnan drove as James Bond, that one, the one that was invisible, that one.
I used to drive a Bentley, what would it be called? It'd be the Arnage Red Label, and it was an absolute beast of a car in terms of driving. The acceleration for, I don't know how much it weighed, but it must have been 3.5 or 4. It felt like it was about 4 tons worth.
Oh my gosh, yes.
But it was just an incredible car, the Arnage R. But yes, the Aston Martin is quite some car as well. So it'd be one of those three would be your dream.
It would be. It would be my it would be my car to take out on the nice days. And I think just stay in touch with my childhood and that passion that drove me all those years when, you know, the only thing that really got me excited was cars. I wasn't really into music as a kid. I wasn't really into sports. And my only passion was something that as a child, I couldn't even do firsthand. And I wondered as I was getting like 15, 16 years old, will I even like driving? I'd been a car enthusiast my whole life without ever turning a wheel. I'm like, maybe I won't like it. Maybe it'll change. It didn't.
I made the mistake yesterday of going online and looking up two cars just to see how much they were. And these are like cars of my youth. And it turns out that, you know, they're cheaper than some of the watches I own that are not that expensive watches. And one was the Volvo T5R in canary yellow. And there was one sitting there for about $4,000. And I was like, oh, I could just buy that. That would be fine. And the other was a Jaguar XJR. And again, I think it was about $5,000. I'm thinking, how is this worth £5,000? I remember driving these as a kid. And thinking this was just the life.
But that's interesting because some of the other cars, like I mentioned in a previous show, like your Toyota Supras, your Skyline R33 GTRs, R34 GTRs, yeah. Nurspec, they are incredible amounts of money. So it seems to be just a small pocket of cars that have shot up dramatically.
I mean, that Volvo T5R is an incredible car to drive. I think it's about 243 horsepower. Yeah, they loved them. And they used to race them in this country.
Police used them. Police used them in Europe and the UK, I think.
Oh, yeah. To try and combat the 90s joyriders. That was the
But still
whole
with enough room to put some traffic cones in the back.
Of course.
And you know, I'm not going to necessarily encourage boosting these things beyond their limits, but that's also on the table with a T5.
Oh, they could take it. Yeah, they could take it.
So between the music, the cars, the watches, the guitars, and the cycling, which would you give up first and which would you give up last?
I think I'm relatively new to the guitar. So if I gave up the guitar, I would be able to continue to enjoy the music. So I guess conditionally, if I had to give up one half of my musical passion, it would be the playing side. Because I can't play like Eddie Van Halen, but I can listen to Eddie Van Halen. So that would be it would be easier to give up me banging away on six strings than him. The cars for me are, I'm surprised how enduring it's been because there have been big gaps in my ability to even stay connected to the car community during the military, during college, during periods when I didn't have a driveway. And yet it's really been so near and dear to me that it's always drawn me back even when I've been remote from it. So watches, I think, are so integral to my identity that I couldn't give those up and I couldn't give the cars up. And as long as I've got the music still in my head, I sort of own it. And I can always roll down the window if I'm driving a V8 Panos and there's my music right there. So I think if I had to narrow it down, it would be first the guitar would go, then the music would go, then between the watches and the cars. Oh, you're really putting me in a spot right here. But I would have to say because...
We ask the tough questions in this
show. Yeah, I know, you're drilling down. But you know what? I got to stay true to who I was as a kid. And I was a car guy as a kid. I was a car boy before I was a car guy. And again, so near and dear to who I am today. I think I'd have to stick with my passion for cars because I was there first. Mm-hmm. But again, we are talking my, you know, options 1A and 1B in terms of favored passions.
It's all mechanical.
That's the title for this show then. Tim Mosso gives up watches.
Yeah, there's your salacious clickbait for the episode.
There we go. We have a clickbait. We're not going to need to mention Rolex in the title at all.
Not at all.
No, it should be Tim Mosso gives up Rolex, Daytona, and Patek Philippe Nautilus.
Let's try it. Well, what we'll do is we'll put out with two titles and we'll see which gets most of the download. Tim Mosso says all bubbles are burst.
No, but
So let's talk. Let's actually talk bubbles for a second and just watch, you know, wider industry stuff. There's obviously been some word from Watchbox to do with Ahmed Siddiqui and also the breakup. Would that be the right word to say between it and Richemont?
Oh, well, just to comment on some of our goings on. We have a partnership with Siddiqui in the Middle East that's open now. And as of Dubai Watch Week, we've rolled out a pre-owned partnership with them. So obviously they're a major authorized dealer and it's a little bit easier as an authorized dealer to take trades if you have a partner that is used to pricing trades. Like if you only ever sold new watches, let's say you have a Rolex dealer and someone comes in and wants to trade a Breitling. First, you don't know what a used Breitling is worth because you never buy used watches. And second, as a Rolex dealer, you wouldn't be able to just put a used Breitling in the case next to your Rolex and expect that everyone would be okay with this. So you also need a way to sell.
You mean Rolex would be okay with this?
I'm sure they, no problem, right? They're cool.
Rolex are a charity. They're supposed to be kind and
cuddly. Oh, right, they're a foundation. I forgot. They're in it for the public good. We have a partnership with Siddiqui, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's basically us providing pre-owned expertise so they can more easily take trades, and we can benefit from the reputation and, you know, obviously huge scope of clients they have in the Middle East. So that's what's going on there. We also have a full-time Watchbox store, so that's the other half the equation. We are full-time on the ground now, at least in Dubai. You asked about Gauffberg and Richemont. We remain authorized dealers of the Richemont brands we have through the end of Richemont's fiscal year. So Richemont's fiscal year starts in March and ends in March. So we are dealers of all those Richemont brands through March of 2020. And then we are authorized service at Gauffberg Watch Repair until March of 2021. So we're dealers through March 2020, authorized service through March of 2021. And it was parting on good terms. It's not like there's any bad blood. It's no secret. We both have an interest in pre-owned Richemont via Watch Finder in the UK. It now has an investment in pre-owned watches, and I think it wants to just put all of its cards into one deck, so to speak, or all of its eggs in one basket. So that's what's going on there. Yeah. But we're on good terms. It was an amicable parting. There's no bad blood.
Yeah, good. And so how do you think that this drawing of the lines between authorized dealers, watch conglomerate owners, and used, pre-owned organizations, how do you think that this dividing up is going to play out in the next, say, 12 to 18 months?
Well, I would say realistically, if we're talking about how it's going to work out in the next 18 months, I don't think we're going to see as much movement as we've seen recently. For example, I do think Richemont is going to try to figure out what it wants to do with Watchfinder, because whereas, for example, Watchbox is more interested in the pre-owned watches themselves, Richemont is very interested in being able to do basically what an authorized dealer would do with a pre-owned watch, which is take it on a trade and then sell a new watch. So if you think about what a OEM like Richemont pays to make a watch, let's say the actual retail price is $60,000 for a watch. Now, let's look at what the production cost is. It's probably somewhere south of $10,000 to make that $60,000 watch. So if a pre-owned dealer is going to buy that watch for, let's say, $30,000 and sell it for $40,000, you're talking about a lot less profit than if you're the manufacturer and you can make it for under 10 and sell it even discounted for 40 grand. If you're putting in, let's just make it a round number, $10,000 to make the watch and you're selling it new, albeit discounted for $40,000, and we're talking $40,000 on a $60,000 retail, that probably isn't going to happen. But even then, you're going to make $30,000 in profit because you're the OEM. You made this thing. Your production cost is so low that you would never want to be explicitly in the business of pre-owned just so you could buy that watch for 30 and sell it for 40. You'd be much more interested in buying a watch pre-owned or taking a trade so you could sell a new watch, which is your real profit center and where the real margins are. Whereas if you're a pre-owned specialist explicitly, then you don't have the ability to make a watch. Watchbox is a pretty impressive operation, but no, I'll reveal this. We can't make a Vacheron. we can't make a Vacheron. We can't make a Gyro Tourbillon. So our sole interest is in actually buying the pre-owned watch. And my question is whether if you're Richemont and your interest is really in selling new watches, because that's where the profit is, and you have that unique ability to make a new watch, are you ever going to embrace the lower profit margins, irregular product condition, boxes, papers, and accessories, and specialized buying that comes with pre-owned? It requires a lot more care. It requires a lot more attention. And ultimately, it's going to involve lower profits than a Richemont is used to making. So that's why I think there might be a little bit of a refractory period or a pause as Richemont tries to figure out whether it really wants to steer people toward buying from Watchfinder as opposed to trading pre-owned watches on new Richemont timepieces with the pre-owned inventory going to Watchfinder so that it can be sold secondarily. It's really just a matter of believing in pre-owned versus new and how much you embrace pre-owned.
And it's a problem because, as you say, Richemont are effectively competing against themselves if they're not very careful. It didn't make a great deal of sense for me them buying it other than, as you say, to provide a conduit to trade watches rather than sell used watches. But Watchfinder's not actually set up for that itself either. The only other thing that made slight sense for me is that because Rolex is such a profit centre, both from an AD's point of view and from a used point of view, it actually allows Richemont to effectively sell Rolex. and to have enough cash to leverage the market and potentially, as we have seen in the UK in recent weeks, actually influence the price of the market.
How do you see the shows, the big ones, Basel, SIHH, the way that that side of thing has changed? Because we've got a lot of listeners that are on this journey, quite new like we are, and I've been to Basel 3 times, I've been to SIHH 2 times. And I've loved it because I was a member of the public, and then thankfully I got press accreditation this year through the website to actually explore more. And I thought it was a great thing. It's going to the Geneva Car Show, it's something like that. How do you see that going forward from a social media point of view for members of the public going to experience things?
Well, it's awfully tough as a member of the general public to get the most out of the trade shows because you wind up looking at a lot of watches in vitrines. And if you don't have private showings, it can be very difficult to be able to get as close to the watches as you'd like. And I think the level of public access you get at like a car show, like the Geneva Motor Show, it's even higher than what you would get at SIHH, which is held in the same building. So I really think that at the moment, the trade show as a sales venue is basically dead. We know that watches are released all year long now. There's no longer the old school phenomenon of all the dealers flocking like the swallows of San Capistrano to Basel to see the new watches, and you wouldn't know until you got there what Rolex was launching. Now, the last 2 years, I've covered Basel from press releases, and I've had the same level of social media volume as when I actually went to Basel in 2016. So you don't need to be there to cover the show. You don't need to be there to see what's launched. And given that two of the holdouts at Basel, Patek and Rolex, basically tell their dealers what they're getting rather than asking dealers to buy lots. You know, given the strength of those brands, they give you an allotment. It's not like you say, okay, I would like to buy 35 5711s. No, they'll tell you how many 5711s you're getting. So between the departures and the fact that some brands that are still there simply make allotments, you don't even have to be there to learn how many Aquanauts you're getting. You'll get that in the mail. They'll tell you. So unless the shows really tilt towards an exclusive consumer focus, the press is able to cover the watches through a combination of press kits and releases, and the retailers no longer have to go there to learn what's new or even to make bids on allocations when they're able to purchase or receive their assignment with Patek and Rolex when they're not able to just name their purchase quantity. This year, there's an attempt to make SIHH more like Watches and Wonders Miami, which was a great organic customer-oriented show in a buyer's market. Like, Miami is where people go to buy watches. It's also where the locals buy a lot of watches. Whereas Basel, historically, has always been something of a backwater. It's not even a center of Swiss watch manufacturing. So no one went to Basel ordinarily to buy watches, and it wasn't a big consumer market for watches. The show existed solely for the sake of dealers and business to business. And it looks like the business to business angle is just about dead. Now, SIHH is supposed to be more like Miami Watches and Wonders this year, but they canceled Miami Watches and Wonders. So what was probably the best local show, you know, Salon QP has also been excellent in the past, and Dubai Watch Week has been excellent, but Miami Watch Week was bigger. And now that's gone. And now we get some sort of hybrid of a consumer show and a business-to-business show. And well, now it's going to be, I think, it's going to be in the spring rather than January. I don't know where these shows go unless they are strictly watch tourism. And they need to be that watch tourism. They need to let people try stuff on. They need to have lots of demonstration prototypes available. It needs to be set up so that they're there first and foremost to engage with collectors and let them have the full VIP experience, because dealers are just not into it anymore. And dealers aren't necessarily the force that they used to be, with a lot of brands going so vertical. Audemars Piguet in the United States very shortly will have no dealers that it doesn't own or in which it's not a joint partner. So between there being fewer dealers and the dealers not needing to go to the shows are gone unless they can reform and focus on consumers. I just got an email yesterday, 24 hours ago, that Grubel Forsey is now pulling out of SIHH, joining Richard Mille and Audemars Piguet as two brands that really don't need the show to sell to dealers and they'd rather just go straight to customers.
Yes, I saw that last night as well, that it's not just Basel that's losing customers or exhibitors. SIHH is suffering just as much. The Japanese citizens, the only major one left. Admittedly, they are the ones that appear to put the most effort into the exhibition, whereas Grand Seiko and Grand Seiko and who, Ricky? As my mind goes blank.
Casio just jumped.
Casio. Exactly. Casio, that's who I was
thinking about. Casio just dropped out in the last week from Basel, and we lost Grubel from SIHH. And if you ask me, other than the Richemont brands, which are going to be at SIHH, I guess now it's Watches and Wonders Geneva, but other than the Richemont brands, the best reason to go to SIHH was to go and see the independents, where you could show up, you could meet, you know, name your watchmaker, you could meet Benoit Mintians of Ressence and sit down with him and talk about his watches. You know, you could go and meet Kerry Voutilainen and talk to him about his watches and try them on. It was the most consumer-focused, consumer-friendly, forward-looking, direct-to-customer trade show experience I've ever had. I would even say that the Carré des Horlogères, which was the independent brand, I call it like a suite for SIHH, was the absolute highlight of my year in terms of trade shows and the ability to see everything from Moser to Grubel 4C within about 20 paces made that the single best experience between Basel, SIHH, or any other show. And if the independents like Grubel 4C start peeling off, there's really no reason to go because you only get to see the Richemont watches, the JLCs, IWCs, and Panerai if you're pressed with an appointment.
Will you be going next year?
I would like to. I would like to go to at least Watches and Wonders Geneva. Basel, to me, I was lucky. I saw the last real Basel World back in 2016 when all of the halls were still open, all of the exhibitors were still in place, and it still had the longest number of days prior to the pairing of the days. There's no reason, in my opinion, to go to Basel. I'm not going to get a private showing with Patek Philippe. So, yeah.
Rick, have we finished our wrist check yet?
Well, not really. I'm wearing a Panerai.
Okay, I'm wearing a Batman.
Because that's what I wear all the time, and that's what you wear all the time. So that's us finished. That's us finished a 55-minute wrist check.
Yes.
Okay, so very quickly then. We know that, like, the various award ceremonies have all been a bit... I think they've all been a bit mince this year. That's Scottish for not very good. I think they've been a bit rubbish. So we're going to launch, as of right now, the McWatches. So Tim Mosso, as our chief judge of the McWatches, what is your watch of the year?
My watch of the year, my personal choice would be the Freak Next, because in terms of importance, I see that watch as legitimately equally significant as the original Freak was back in 2001. I think more of that technology is going to find its way into other watches between the harmonic unitary resonator that is the balance, the regulator, the escapement all in one, just the use of micrometric pre-etched silicon components. I think that watch is going to have a bigger technology footprint in terms of how it changes the landscape, not just for UN, but for watches broadly. It's a more sophisticated version, in my opinion, of the DeFi inventor. And I just feel that Ulysse Nordén's take on the harmonic oscillator is going to be more viable broadly than what LVMH is doing.
Don't say things like that because we've both
got
inventors.
We keep waiting for our inventors. Yes. Okay. It's now a year and 3 months we've been waiting. Yeah, have you got any insider news about the Zenith that we don't know about? Because we keep getting fobbed off with interesting emails saying not currently available in your territory, which doesn't bode well.
Yeah, we believe they're having problems similar to what TAG have had with the Isograph, which is that it's broken.
Oh, I've heard that it might never even ship with that hairspring, the carbon hairspring.
We have heard that also.
I have heard that also. And then it may never ship.
Well, you've told us about your favourite watch of the year. Now it's time, since it's Christmas, it's Turkey of the Year. What would you say is the one that maybe wasn't so good?
I would say the Turkey of the Year, if I have to be super critical, I thought that the Louis Monet GPHG chronograph nomination was a watch that was just too large, oversized, weird open dial, presence, wrist stance, appearance as though it were something culled from Basel World 2008. Like, it just felt completely out of step. But I would say that watch was probably wrong for our time. And I'm going to say one Turkey that was actually a very well-made watch was the Audemars Piguet Code 1159 three-hand date. I thought that watch cost a tremendous amount of money to make, both case, movement, and dial, and yet it didn't look its price. And I found that unforgivable because you could tell in the hand, in person, that it was an incredibly well-made, thoughtfully detailed combination gold and lacquered dial into which a ton of energy was lavished. But for me, it looked cheap, and that was unforgivable because I'm pretty sure that came directly from the top at AP. And while the watch is beautifully made, if they had just combined it with the dial from the Supersonnerie, from the Tourbillon with the gradient enamel, or even the aventurine dial of the perpetual calendar, we would have been talking about the Code 1159 as one of the most desirable new watches of the year. Instead, it's an object of infamy, and for only one reason, the dial. Not because they didn't spend the money, but because you can't tell from photos that they didn't spend the money. So I'm simultaneously critiquing the critique of the watch while acknowledging that the appearance is anodyne and anonymous on what should have been a make-or-break dress watch product for Audemars Piguet.
Well, we've spoken quite a lot about the 1159, more so from a point of view that if they hadn't hyped it up so much, if they hadn't tried to say, well, when the Royal Oak came out, nobody really liked it then, so it became a superstar, therefore this will as well. Because of the PR aspect, that's why we kind of said it wasn't the greatest thing in the world, but to hear you talk about it in that way, that makes a lot of sense as well. And who would you say is maybe most improved of the year? Which brands that you've had your eye on in the last couple of years have upped their game and have brought it to the table this year?
I would say a significant improvement we've seen over the last 2 years from both Lange and Vacheron, and I think I'm going to focus on Vacheron bottoming out in the year 2017, when it just seemed like everything they rolled out was anonymous, forgettable, and irrelevant. They had a couple of high complications that represented minuscule volume. The run-of-the-mill watches, you know, their general production in 2017 was so lackluster that I can even scarcely remember what they did that year. It was almost like they had a refractory fallback after the 2016 Overseas 3, and they'd run out of ideas. So last year, I thought the watches they launched were of exceptional quality, and while a lot of people got really up in arms over the basic 56 not having a Geneva Seal movement, the rest of the 56 collection was outstanding and offered in steel right from the get-go, which is something every brand in the high horology space should be doing. So Vacheron this year came out swinging. The craft art pieces, the métier d'art, the new blue dial dress watch timepiece, the blue dial patrimonies, the new Overseas Tourbillon, which was beautifully executed and thoughtfully so, a wearable everyday sports tourbillon. And then finally, also the Twin Beat, which was a technology that just pushed the limits in a way that no one else had even conceived. Think about that. You put that watch on your wrist, it's 42 millimeters and thin, and yet it has a 65-day standby power reserve. When you talk about watches with weeks of power reserve, in general, you're talking about watches like the Lange 31 or the Hublot LaFerrari that are the size of hockey pucks and they need to be wound with power tools. And with the Twin Beat, you had a timepiece that was not just a gorgeous and thoughtfully designed perpetual calendar, but the perpetual calendar was energy efficient. It was two movements in one watch. It was Vacheron's first embrace of new technologies with the silicon escapement system for the low frequency escapement. It was still Geneva hallmark, and it was a wearable watch with 65 days of autonomy. If you're going to ask me, Tim, what type of watch should have weeks of power reserve to sit between usages, I would say it would be some sort of a high complication, especially a complex calendar. Vacheron launched it with a perpetual. That technology will find its way to other watches, and I would not be shocked if, a little bit like the Freak Next and the DeFi Inventor, other brands start looking over their shoulders and thinking, why didn't we think of that? When watches aren't being worn, they don't need the full high beat amplitude and impulse energy to keep time. So for me, that was significant. In terms of watches that, you know, represent great value, probably the most interesting watch, and it's been savaged, was the Tudor P01, because they took a risk there. Everyone complains about them releasing unlimited Black Bay variants, and people grouse about this and they agitate, and then Tudor finally does something genuinely risky, risking a backlash when they could have just launched whatever, a Black Bay calendar or a Black Bay black and blue or whatever would have pushed the buttons and generated the sales. Instead, they courted controversy and a backlash by doing something that's not only very true to their history, but also polarizing and niche. And it's exactly the kind of thing Rolex itself itself would never do. So I applaud Tudor for doing something different, taking a risk and staying true to their heritage, while frankly alienating a lot of people who could have been, as we say in the United States, easy layups by just putting out a black and blue bezel Black Bay.
I think some of the backlash, again, they got was because they teased so much and people thought or expected or longed for a sub. And it never came out. So anything they brought out, they were going to turn their heads against. But no, that was a good sort of roundup of exactly what's been happening. So, Rick, I think we are almost out of time. So do you want any last questions?
I've got just one last thing. So it has been mooted, maybe in chats, etc., that there may one day be some staff changes within the media scene at Watchbox, both of yourself and possibly others. So where, how long can we expect to see you on our screens? And Josh Thanos has obviously come back. You've got TGV still involved. Do we expect further moving of chairs in the future? I keep on seeing folk mentioning you taking the LSATs from time to time.
No, that's absolutely true. I am thinking of moving on, not for money. I do all right here at Watchbox and they like me. More in terms of intellectual challenge, I think we have one life and it's easy to settle into routines, especially when they're comfortable and relatively straightforward. At this point, I admit I can shoot videos one take without blinking. I can operate on cruise control and live broadcast your podcasts. I've got a database in my head, photographic of watches dating back decades. All the tools are there to do what I'm doing now for another decade easily. But to challenge myself and also stay true to my values, first pushing my mind to uncomfortable places and taken not just the road less traveled, but one that would be perhaps a little bit more meaningful from a values standpoint, an ethical standpoint, and I think just a mental rigor standpoint. Making the most of the gifts I have while I still have them, in other words. So that's absolutely true. I am thinking of tapering my time with the company, possibly in the spring and winding up. Now, they might touch base with me and say, we really want to keep you around. So we're on great terms. I have nothing but respect for our management. And on that front, you know, I'm always open to anything. But I am looking at pursuing what I see as a good fit for my skills and also a values-based long-term ambition that I would rather satisfy before I'm looking at being a first-year associate or first-year attorney at age 45.
It's often struck me that there is a moral underpinning to what you do, some of the comments you've made. Actually, some of the one or two of the controversies that have hit Watchbox over the time. I remember one particular video that I think was pulled eventually, which was put in and it was about financing watch purchases, etc. Is there then a particular area of law that's of interest to you because of said underlying moral compass that it looks like you've got?
Yes. Labour law is very interesting to me. I think the best way to live in a better world is to live in a world where people feel like the system works for them. When people feel like the system doesn't work for them, they're driven to one extreme or the other. And I think just in terms of fairness, trying to create a better country, trying to create a better world to live in, helping folks out, working folks is probably the most noble and I think also self-sustaining way you can make an impact. Because for every one case you help, I think you create an advocate for law, order, due process, belief in the system. And, you know, as Edward Deming once said with regard to manufactured goods, bad word of mouth is toxic public relations, whereas a satisfied customer is your best advertising. So I really see that as worthwhile. Regarding other personnel here at Watchbox, I couldn't possibly speak beyond my personal experience. A lot of folks don't realize that I don't have a whole lot of executive remit here, if I might say that. I'm not involved in comings and goings of personnel, and I'm really only involved in production of the work that has my face or my name on it. So as a writer and as a voice for the company, you'll always know when you're hearing from me because it will be Tim Masso, my voice, my face, my name.
Well, all I would say is we need lawyers in Scotland too. And we have watches over here. And we have actually a growing watch media. So if you fancy practicing law in this country, you'd be more than welcome. Yep. Have you ever been to Scotland? Have you been to the UK?
I have been to the UK. I've been to London, and not just the airport. I've been out and about the city. And I would love to spend more time, definitely in Scotland, find my way outside of the cities and just get a better sense of the country as a whole. Because I think in the United States, you know, we ask, like, well, why do they call it Great Britain? I mean, it's not that big. I'm like, well, yeah, it's a greater Britain because there are different nations within it. And I would like to explore all the different nationalities of the UK and really get a sense of those lands outside, you know, basically the urban south. So yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Well, you'd be more than welcome. It'd be great to have you over here. Well, thank you very, very much for spending this time with us. It's been a pleasure. I do genuinely feel like we have completed podcasting.
We have.
By having the person on that has probably influenced us. I have an IWC 3750 simply because yes. of the videos I watched yes. of yours all about it. So, yeah, you're to blame. I'm sending you the invoice.
I'm after a GLC Amvox too. I'm keeping my eye out for one of those.
The most innovative watch of the 2000s was the Amvox 2. Previous, past, satisfied yep. owner, I can endorse that. Thank you so much, guys. It's been an honor to be invited. Thank you for bearing with me through all the delays and setbacks. This has been one of the highlights of my time in the space.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for coming. Tim, why don't you tell everybody where to find you on the internet?
All right. You guys can always find me on the internet on YouTube, Watchbox Reviews, or just type in Tim Masso and you'll probably find your way to me. Instagram, I am Tim_Masso. It is not a corporate Instagram. It's private. And I just post the watches that interest me most, which sometimes have absolutely no commercial upside. So you know it comes from the heart. But that's Tim_Masso on Instagram.
Thank you for listening. And as you say, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Wear your watches in great health and good times.